Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
A packed agenda today. I'm going to start with some comments about the geopolitical situation, something that Jim and I promised to do all year, because there is so much going on, unfortunately, with respect to war. And of course, everybody sees the headlines every single day from Gaza, and we have very strong reactions from all sorts of different people to those headlines. One of those reactions is in Kyiv, in Ukraine. Much as everybody, including Ukrainians, sympathize with the plight of people caught up in the war in Gaza, there is a sort of regret or something, because the war in Gaza is sucking all the oxygen of publicity away from Ukraine. And one of the things that we know in wartime is that publicity and propaganda are very important tools and weapons. And yes, we do hear about Ukraine occasionally in the news, particularly with respect to the non-appearance of American aid, thanks to the antics of Republicans in Congress. But one of the contributory factors to the fact that Ukraine is no longer a daily news item on our screens is that Gaza is. And that's all very well, because there are other wars going on that attract no headlines, hardly at all. And if you Google the Sudanese civil war, you get a really interesting set of answers. First of all, you get three suggestions from Wikipedia about the three different civil wars that have taken place and indeed are taking place since the 1950s. Some of them overlap. There aren't many peaceful periods in Sudan's history over the last 70 years or so. Wikipedia will also, as well as those three most definite civil wars, give you four other suggestions for things that have happened and are happening in Sudan that might be considered civil wars. All sorts of fighting, all sorts of death and destruction. And little of this gets any publicity at all. There's been a little bit today, which really is why my attention was drawn to it, because the BBC have reached the front line in the Sudanese civil war, at least a team of BBC journalists. For the first time, no other journalists have been present, and their reporting is tightly controlled. And there's all sorts of things that are very striking about their reports from Sudan. First of all, names like Khartoum and Omdurman evoke a certain memory in people with certainly British education. And these were battles. Battle of Omdurman was something that took place in 1898. And Winston Churchill was actually a journalist present, just like the BBC journalist present at Omdurman today. And that, back then, a poorly equipped army of 50,000 Sudanese warriors was wiped out by a British Egyptian army half its size. I'm exaggerating to make a point, really, that one was armed with machine guns and the other was armed with spears. But that's the way it goes. But there's been another battle of Omdurman in the last while. As I say, it's the front line, and the pictures, such as they are, you never know when you're looking at pictures what exactly you are looking at. But they're very reminiscent of the pictures that I think are coming out of Gaza and the reports of gang rapes by militias, torture and mass hunger with a threat of starvation. Lots of people are talking about millions of people in Sudan facing food insecurity. That phrase is used for people in Gaza, of course. Now, I don't think there's a hierarchy of sympathy. I don't think there's a league table of who we should feel sympathy for relative to others. Obviously, this is all awful, whether we are looking at Ukraine, Gaza, and Sudan. But Jim, I don't want to court controversy unnecessarily. And it's a question, which is a very unfair one for you, really, because it's a question for myself. And maybe it's just rhetorical and you don't say anything because we'll probably get ourselves into trouble. But when I think about these wars, and indeed others, when I think about these people, tens of thousands of people killed and injured in Sudan and in Gaza, and hundreds of thousands killed and injured in Ukraine. But I only see protest marches through London, Dublin, and elsewhere about one of these wars. Any idea why that might be the case, Jim? Or would you prefer to kick for touch on that one?
That's a very good question, Chris. And to be honest, I don't know the answer. I've been following the war in Sudan for some time. Rory Stewart talks about it a lot. It is absolutely savage, but is getting very little attention this side of the world. The Ukraine war, we had in the early days protests outside the Russian embassy in Rathgar here in Dublin on an ongoing basis. I've no idea, despite the fact I live quite close, I have no idea whether they're still ongoing or not. But the whole focus of attention very definitely is on the situation in Gaza. And I think one thing to understand about that is that the Irish always appear to have had a very strong affinity with the plight of Palestinian people, particularly those on the left. And perhaps there's an element here of anti-British imperialism. I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but definitely it is the case that Gaza, the situation there, dominating everything at the moment. A lot of people are actually afraid to talk about it because you immediately get accused of being anti-Semitic if you do that. I certainly think it is justifiable to be critical of what the Israeli Defense Forces are doing in Gaza at the moment without being accused of being anti-Semitic. But that's not how the debate actually operates here in this country, or indeed elsewhere. But I go back to your point, Chris, you know, it is a fact. There's a hell of a lot more attention being paid to the situation in Gaza than in Ukraine or than in Sudan, or indeed in many of the other countries in Africa, particularly where there are wars going on at the moment. If you look at all of the publicity out of the visit of Irish ministers to the United States over Patrick's weekend, Gaza basically dominated all of the discourse. Leo Varadkar, excuse me, went quite tough, I think, on Biden in some ways. Certainly the United States media picked up very strongly on what Varadkar was saying about call for a ceasefire and so on. But Gaza did dominate. It's as if there's nothing else going on, which is a problem, and it's a pity.
Maybe we can only focus on one war at a time. Maybe our emotional and brain spaces only allow for a certain limited attention span. I don't know either, Jim. I just note it with interest. And I guess lots of people will come up with lots of different versions. You know, the war in Gaza is one that the West can do something about. Perhaps the West is responsible for. Whereas no matter what we do with Sudan, that's a civil war that we can do nothing about. These sorts of arguments will be made. I don't know how much water they hold, but I can hear those sorts of arguments being made. The one in Ukraine, I think, is equally worthy of our attention. I think they're all equally worthy of our attention. Let's be clear about that. But the hundreds of thousands of deaths, the forced movement of children across borders from Ukraine to Russia, the mass rapes, the awful things, the torture, the human rights abuses that are going on there, I don't think have attracted enough protest in the West, to be honest. That's a judgment call of mine. Not everybody will agree with it, of course. But I just note these things are interesting. They are, you know, the modern zeitgeist. They are, it sort of defines who we are in many ways, is that we feel more strongly about Gaza than we do about Ukraine and Sudan and indeed elsewhere. So let's leave it at that, Jim, and get back to
it. Can I make one further intervention, if I may? And that is the role of media. If you watch news stories here on Irish media at the moment, it is dominated by Gaza. We get a lot of coverage. We get a lot of photos and video from what's happening in Gaza. Very little from Ukraine at the moment and absolutely nothing from Sudan, pretty much. So why is the media doing this? Is it because they don't have the resources to cover the other wars? Or is it because they're actually responding to where they believe the viewer demand is, and that's Gaza?
I don't know, Jim. It is interesting. But again, in defense of one part of the media, as I began this section of our podcast, the BBC have reached the front line in the civil war in Sudan and are reporting back from it today. And that's a first. And so it's not all media are just focusing exclusively on Gaza. We have the BBC's reports today. And anybody interested in what's going on in Sudan, the horror of what is going on in Sudan, should have a look at those reports. They're available online. I know you don't necessarily have access to iPlayer in Ireland to get the back catalogue of BBC programmes, but you can certainly access their website and have a look there. Jim, let's move on.
Yeah, Chris, it's a big week for central banks. We have the US Federal Reserve meeting tonight, Wednesday, to decide an interest rate policy. The market view at the beginning of the year was that the Fed would deliver 6 cuts this year. Currently, 3 cuts are priced in the second half of the year. There's no chance that the Federal Reserve will move on rates, but as always, it's the commentary and the sentiment that comes out from the press conference from Jay Powell that will be worth watching. We have the Bank of England meeting on Thursday. No change in rates expected there either, but also the forward guidance from Bank of England will be interesting because it seems inevitable that UK rates, in my view at least, are coming down later in the year. And indeed, we got UK inflation this morning. The headline rate has fallen from 4% to 3.4%, a little bit lower than market expectations. And the decline in the headline rate of inflation is sort of pretty widespread. Food inflation has gone from 7% to 5%. Core inflation, excluding food and energy, gone from 5.1% to 4.5%. Services inflation has gone from 6.5% to 6.1%. But the headline rate is now at a 2.5-year low. And the expectation is that over the coming months, the headline rate will fall below 2% for the first time in quite some time. So that certainly will strengthen the Bank of England's hand if it so desires to start cutting interest rates. But the other central bank meeting this week has occurred already. On Monday, the Bank of Japan ended its 17-year, I think, negative interest rate scenario. We saw the first rate increase in 17 years. The rate has gone from minus 0.1% to plus 0 to 0.1%. So a marginal increase in rates, but symbolically it is important because, as I say, it does represent the first tightening of interest rate policy in 17 years. It also moved away from its yield curve control policy because it was intervening in the market, buying bonds to force long-term interest rates down. That policy has also ended. And the backdrop to that is that inflation is now above the Bank of Japan's target of 2%. It's running at 2.2%. The economy is growing modestly, 1.9% GDP growth last year. But for a mature, developed economy like Japan that has little in the way of demographic growth, in fact, it's the opposite. That sort of growth rate is reasonably healthy. But a big week for the Bank of Japan. And I actually hadn't spotted in a while, but the yen is falling out of bed, really. At the moment, it's approaching 152 against the dollar. A year ago, it had been down at about 135. So the yen is under significant pressure.
Can I just add there that one of the things that the Bank of Japan did was indeed buy bonds, that yield curve control thing that you referenced there. But you and every central bank, to a greater or lesser extent since the financial crisis, has been engaged in similar activities. It's quantitative easing, it's old-fashioned money printing, it attracts all sorts of different labels. But the unique thing that the Bank of Japan did is it also bought equities. It bought the stock market. I haven't seen a profit and loss statement for their equity purchases, but given that the Nikkei, as we have said recently, is now past its previous peak of 1989, I'm guessing that they bought all these equities at much lower prices than they are today. So they've made a lot of money.
Yeah.
And the I guess we should congratulate them and hope that they spend their profits wisely. But I think that actually speaks to another thing that I've said on this podcast before, is that the greatest intergenerational policy intervention, or one of the greatest intergenerational policy interventions that any government could make, would be to give each newborn child a global equity ETF to the tune of, say, 5,000 euros. Now, the reason why I say that is partly why the Bank of Japan has been buying equities is that over the long term, you will be paid to hold those equities. Data, such as it is, says that if the future is like the past, you will get a real return on global equities of around 5%, say-ish. Maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. But that's what history, such as it is, tells us. That doesn't guarantee future performance. All the usual regulatory caveats have to apply. But if you gave a baby an asset that's going to yield 5% real terms, and then said, okay, you can only cash this in when you're, I don't know, 30, when you, you know, either to pay off a bit of your mortgage or to get that first mortgage. Have you any idea what that 5,000 would have become, Jim? I'll tell you, it's in excess of 20 grand.
Wow. Okay.
And that would, you know, if every baby is given 5,000 euros, so how many babies are born in Ireland every year, Jim? You'd have that statistic at your fingertips, wouldn't you, Jim?
No. No, I wouldn't, Chris.
I know, neither do I. But I don't think it would be a particularly expensive measure. And I think it would be fantastic if you set it up, because that would mean that a couple of any gender getting together at the age of 30 would have a deposit of 40 grand, in excess of 40 grand for their house in real terms.
Yeah.
Or to spend however they wished. This is not just for house purchases, of course. And there's all this talk about saving for a rainy day and setting up sovereign wealth funds, which, of course, the Irish government is doing. I think it'd be much, much simpler. Buy a global ETF, which is a low-cost vehicle for investing in every company in the world, every listed company in the world. Put a structure around it that it can't be touched for 30 years. And see what difference that makes to the next generation. And do it every year for every cohort of babies born. And rather than doing tax cuts, and I think that would be the best possible investment.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Auto-enrollment in the pension system is being introduced in Ireland later this year.
And you should extend that to babies, auto-enroll babies.
Exactly. That's the point I was going to make. Much better idea.
Okay, well, maybe we should become the party of auto-enrollment, Jim.
Maybe we should, actually. So anyway, Chris, big week on the interest rate front for messages other than the Bank of Japan's actually concrete action. One sort of fly in the ointment at the moment is that oil prices are certainly creeping up again.
Brent and gas prices.
and indeed gas prices are up a bit, but Brent crude this morning approaching $87 a barrel. That had been down in the low 70s late last year. There's a number of factors driving it, not least OPEC, but the Ukrainians are targeting a lot of oil production facilities in Russia at the moment.
A Ukrainian general explained their policy of attacking Russian refineries in Russia, because Russia has a lot of these things, because it has a lot of oil. There are different aspects to this, but one is the way the Ukrainian described this. He said that Russia is essentially a gas station with an army attached. Now, he was using gas in the way that Americans use it, gas, petroleum. Which, is, if you think about it, is a very interesting way of putting it, because one of the things that they've been attacking have been diesel refineries. And if you're wondering why diesel starts ticking up in price, it may have already done so in your local petrol station or diesel station. Russia is a huge exporter of refined diesel. And a lot of the facilities that have been attacked have been diesel refineries.
Yeah.
So that could impact on diesel in particular, but petrol prices in general are likely to tick up in the next few days and weeks if the recent rise in oil prices is sustained. And it's going to complicate at the margin. It's not huge yet, but it's going to complicate this interest rate cutting story that we keep postponing in America and in the UK. And we've had better than expected, slightly better than expected inflation numbers out of the UK this morning, and better than expected falls in German, something called producer prices. I know you're going to give us the exact numbers in a second, Jim, but the story there, particularly for that German number, is falling energy prices. And that source of disinflation, if you like, of inflation falling back, looks as if it might be, for the time being at least, coming to an end. And so I think that must be a slight concern for central bankers, and it must be a concern for anybody that hopes their mortgage rate or whatever else they're borrowing is coming down soon.
Yeah, Chris, it must be a concern, and maybe a concern, whatever way you want to put it. But I kind of tend to look at it differently, in the sense that rising energy costs feeding through to higher petrol, diesel, electricity, whatever. I actually think the negative economic effect of that, particularly in the European economy, which is struggling, far outweighs any inflationary impulse. And that, because energy prices are rising in a slow economy, should not mean that central banks should delay or change tack on the interest rate front, in my view. So I just think the disinflationary effect of higher oil prices outweighs the inflationary effect, to be honest, due to the transmission into the real economy.
I can see where you're going with that one. I mean, if you take Germany, for example, that is, German industry is so dependent on energy in a way that Irish industry isn't, for example. I can see where you're going, that the rise in energy prices is like a tax hike on the economy, effectively. And that's why the economy weakens as a result. So yeah, but you know what the central bankers in Europe are like, Jim? They're not going to pay any attention to you and me.
No, they're not.
Definitely not you anyway.
Chris, there was another story that piqued my interest over the last couple of days. I remember fondly the days when Steve Jobs spoke at the annual Apple get-together, where he launched the latest product, be it an iPhone, an iPod, an iPad, whatever. Okay, the NVIDIA conference is going on at the moment. Jensen Huang, the CEO, has announced new AI chips that will be twice as powerful at training AI models than what they currently have. NVIDIA controls 95% of the market for AI chips. Its share price is up 240% over the last 12 months. It's now the third most valuable company in the United States. And the razzmatazz around the NVIDIA meeting is quite extraordinary. As I say, it is reminiscent of the Steve Jobs Apple product launch meetings back in the day. The other AI story that I think is really significant is that Microsoft has just hired Mustafa Suleiman, who was the founder of Inflection and DeepMind AI. as head of its AI business, basically. And Mustafa Suleiman is the guy who wrote the book that I've referred to a number of times called The Coming Wave. So would appear to be a major move by Microsoft to try and get some of the AI action.
Yeah, and it's still propelling stock markets higher. And we have all of that debate about whether there's a bubble. There's weird stuff going on in NVIDIA shares. I read a report yesterday that said that some people were betting on Monday morning, and this is all in the United States, I suspect, via some weird derivatives market, that NVIDIA's share price would double by the end of the week. And that's on the back of it going exponential recently. So there's all sorts of nuttiness going on. And you begin to suspect, as we have talked about, that this might, at least for a short period of time, if not for a longer period, all end in tears for some of these companies. But yes, the difference between the tech bubble of 25 years ago and today is that these companies, NVIDIA included, or NVIDIA especially, actually, is making serious money. There is a profit earnings story. Other companies have been going up a lot as well. There's a really interesting company in Taiwan called TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, I think it's called. And that share price has suddenly taken off as well. Not on the back of an earnings story, at least not yet. So it's different to NVIDIA. It's just because it makes chips that are going to be part of this AI revolution, it is generally supposed. TSMC is a company that over the years has been a great investment for anybody. But it's interesting, A, that it's going up on the back of the coattails of NVIDIA and other chip makers. There are other chip makers in the United States that have done almost as well as in NVIDIA, much smaller companies. But think about what I just said, Jim, about that TSMC. It's Taiwan. And this is a particular example of a more general point. I began the podcast talking about war in three different parts of the world, noting that war is taking place not just in three different parts of the world, but they are really nasty and vicious wars, any one of which could spill over and have even bigger consequences for our comfortable lives. All of them could, and other wars could as well. There's the Trump presidency, there's China and Taiwan, there's right-wing populism in Europe, there's Sinn Féin going to take office in Ireland. And yet, the markets continue to stay up. Bond markets don't care. And share prices in Taiwan, the country that is the focus of Chinese attention, is going up. Investors don't seem to share these worries that you and I and in many, many other commentators have about the state of the world. And that tells me one of two things. One is that markets don't know how to price risk, and they're just getting it wrong, as they do from time to time. But if they are getting it wrong, they really, really must be getting it wrong this time, because they're all signaling one thing: things are fine. And if anything, things economic, financial, are getting better, and not even to worry about Taiwan and China. So the markets are telling you and me, Jim, we're getting it wrong and we need to go and lie down and get over ourselves. What do you think?
Yeah, perhaps it's telling us that companies are actually more powerful than governments.
Possibly, yeah.
I should actually point out, Chris, that my investment in crypto.
Oh, yes. Go on. Please enlighten me.
€200. Okay. I paid €2 commission. So 198 was invested, went up to 215. I didn't take profits. And yesterday went down to 184 because apparently there was a flash attack on crypto trading. So I'm underwater at the moment, Chris. But I will let you know as soon as I get over water again.
And you're keeping the faith.
Absolutely. I'm amazed at how little feedback I got to that revelation. But anyway, yes, here we go.
Normally we get all sorts of tons of feedback about crypto whenever we mention it.
Yeah, we do indeed. Chris, I want to bring us back home a little bit again about domestic politics. Fine Gael has 35 seats in the Dáil since the 2020 election. 11 voted in at that stage as TDs. One has gone, Owen Murphy went early in that political cycle, but 10 others have announced they are not standing. The latest was a Galway TD called Ciarán Cannon, a young enough guy. He's not running. He just says politics has become way too toxic. Two MEPs on the Fine Gael. Take us existing sitting MEPs, Deirdre Clune in Cork and Francis Fitzgerald here in Dublin are not standing again. So we talk about opinion polls, we talk about Sinn Féin, and we, you know, we ruminate on when Sinn Féin is up or down a couple of points in various opinion polls. But the reality is, if Fine Gael is losing that many TDs, you know, could the party get absolutely decimated? And I don't know. One of the things that sort of bothers me about all of this is the fact that why in the name of God would you run for politics given the environment today, particularly if you're a female?
I think that that explains in many countries, certainly here in the UK, the low quality of politicians that we currently have. There are no big beasts. There are no intellectual giants. There are no, you know, extraordinary people anymore running for office. They're all pretty jobsworth, mediocre, ordinary people. I mean, my God, they call Michael Gove the last intellectual in the Tory party. I'm not, you know, I mean, you're laughing quite rightly. So, I think it's very sad. I think that the quality of our political establishment is a big, big issue here in the UK. And you're telling me that it's going to be in Ireland as well. I just, as an aside, talking about Irish politics, I had occasion, and I really regret this, to wander into some websites of the far right in Ireland, such as they are. And I know that they're tiny. They are not representative. And it was an extraordinary thing to see the things that they stand for, the things that they believe, contrasted with the things that they stand against and the things that they don't believe in. And it was like strolling into a right-wing entity party website that anywhere. And the list of things that they're against is the same as it is here, as it is in Italy, as it is in France, as in Germany. Top of the list is immigrants.
Ah, yeah.
Second on the list is the EU,
yeah.
You know, the Brussels bashing. Third on the list is Davos and the globalists. And you know, you could have predicted the list of things. And you again wonder, do these people ever actually come up with any original ideas themselves? They're just copying the Steve Bannon thing in the United States, the Nigel Farage thing here in the UK. And it's laughable. I feel almost contaminated by having looked at this stuff because it is just so vile.
Chris, can I ask you, did you know, I actually didn't on the last couple of days, that the far right, particularly in Italy, have been heavily influenced by the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien and Lord of the Rings?
I'd heard that, but I can't profess to have any insight into that at all because I've never read anything by Tolkien. I've never seen the movies, never read any of the books. They've just never appealed to me. So I've no idea why that would be the case. But if you're telling me it's fantasy, then I can understand.
Well, no, I was listening to a piece about Giorgio Meloni there recently, and there was a deep dive into Italian history going back to Mussolini. But, you know, the far right has been sort of simmering under the surface and above the surface at times with people like Berlusconi and now with Giorgio Meloni. But the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien keep featuring in a lot of the narrative that's coming out. And I think it's, I don't know exactly what the explanation is. I mean, I've seen all the films, I've read most of his stuff over the years, and it strikes me that perhaps the victors in Lord of the Rings were really the sort of on the downtrodden, weak, sort of traditional, old-fashioned types. And that, you know, it's anti-modernity and so on. I'm not sure, but I think
it's also the case. I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, or at least in Tolkien's mouth. He's don't speak ill of the dead. But I have read somewhere that his politics were of a nasty right-wing kind. I don't know whether you'd heard that.
I hadn't until the last couple of days.
Yeah. So maybe it's his politics as much as his writings that are
appealed. I don't know.
Jim, we should call it there.
Okay, Chris, I just want to mention one final point, and that is that today Michael McGrath, the Minister for Finance, is briefing his cabinet colleagues on the relaunched, about to be relaunched EU fiscal rules. laying out medium-term budgetary plans. You know, budget deficit can't exceed 3% of GDP. Debt GDP ratio has to be below 60%. And governments will have to present a five-year net spending projection, and that countries will not be allowed to deviate over the life cycle from those projections. And apparently, these new EU fiscal rules will get their first outing in Ireland when the budget is being presented in October. That's all the detail we have at this stage, but I just think it's bizarre that going back to this straitjacket again of fiscal rules.
These rules will not survive first contact with the enemy.
Exactly.
And the enemy in this case being reality.
Chris, our next podcast, I want to talk about insoluble problems, okay?
Absolutely. And in that vein, I also want to talk about UK politics and the economy.
Super.
Cheers, mate.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.